too much fun up here. I want to start by, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2581. And do you want to come up? It was Mr. Holcomb. And Patrick's going to explain the bill to us while you get set up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2581 would declares that vermiculture, culture raising of worms, is an agricultural activity and makes vermiculture products subject to regulation as agricultural commodities. The staff measure summary indicates that there is that we had not received a fiscal revenue impact statement. We do have a no revenue impact statement on the measure we got this morning. We are still waiting for a fiscal impact statement on the measure.
Well, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Holcomb, and why don't you just tell us why we need this bill and tell us what you came to do.
Okay. Vermiculture is the raising and breeding of worms. All right. Now, you have a bait industry. You have a supplemental protein source industry. And you have the manufacture, or after you get done, you have the castings, which is probably the greatest value of all. It's an agricultural soil amendment. We've been in the USDA SBIR Small Business Innovative Research Program for the last 5 years. We've had two successful phase one and two successful phase twos. With agronomic application of the product, we're controlling soil nematodes, aphids, cabbage butterflies, hornworms, flea beetles. It appears at this point, although we don't know the vehicle, that once the pests have eaten on the plant, they go away uninclined to propagate. So it's affecting the propagation ratios on the indigenous pests that are in the fields. It qualifies as an organic pesticide because it's non-toxic to the target species or target varieties. We're also, with agronomic application, controlling verticillium wilt, Cetophora, pyrethrum, white powdery mildew on grapes, and there's five or six others that we've tested in the last 5 years. We've been working with the University of Ohio on this program. Dr. Clive Edwards is our head researcher, I guess, for the University of Ohio. And the idea is that you can bring this to a farm that can add an additional cash flow or income by selling the worms into the protein industry, by selling the castings into the agricultural, horticultural, and nursery business. And again, they can increase their own yields by applying it to their fields. The idea is to be able to produce a volume of castings that would be applicable to address a market, let's say, in Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. We did a market study 3 years ago that showed there's somewhere between $30 and $60 million market available out there in the industry for horticulture, agriculture, orchards, vineyards, and everything else. And to be able to make it a primary use in an agricultural area really helps, because otherwise we have to put the system or put the worms into industrial areas to be able to do this. I can't do it in my backyard at home if I want to do 30 or 40 or 50 tons a day. So when you put it into industrial areas, it gets really expensive. As an example, when I collect the feed for the worms, if I had farm plates on my truck, well, at the fuel prices, you can imagine. I mean, you can see right there where the help or where the savings would be. California and Oregon already have them, or California and Washington already have it on there. Michigan, Georgia, a lot of the southeastern states and upper Midwest states where they do a lot of fishing because of the bait industry, they're already on the list there. So I don't know if we're lagging behind in that point or if it's just never been approached before. But it's a good, solid industry. It doesn't take up a lot of space. We have developed a piece of equipment that, the one we have in Oregon City right now is 8 feet wide, 80 feet long. And it probably does 2,000 or 3,000 pounds of feed a day, which produces 3 to 4 yards of castings on a daily basis. So you're not going to have groundwater issues. You're not going to have vector issues with it. And at the same time, we can use it to clean up a lot of issues, because you can use dairy manure, you can use a lot of things that become agricultural environmental issues, and you can clean up dairies, meat operations, both aviary and cattle, and reduce their manure issues, at the same time produce a high quality product to market back into that region or that area. I don't know. I could go on for hours on this. What is there? I do questions better than I just, because I don't know if I'm telling you what you need to know.
Well, Mr. Holman, are there any questions from the committee? They have several. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's Mr. Holcomb, right? We want need you to state your name.
For the Dan Holcomb.
Holcomb.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Most folks these days try to avoid government regulation. And if I understand this bill, you're actually asking to become a regulated agricultural practice.
Yes. Why?
Why?
Because I can't make it a primary function of my farm to do the worms. It has to be, I have to incorporate it into cows or chickens, and I got enough to do. there's enough to do just you know, doing the worms, because if you're going to address, protein issues as a supplemental feed protein, worms are 93% protein. There's more protein in a pound of worms than there is a pound of beef. No offense, or, you know, but there is, and this can be used as a supplemental feed in animal feeds, which you can get into issues of the rendered beef that's going into feeds now that is questionable, you know.
Okay, and I appreciate that, but I was just trying to understand why you wanted to become classified as
an agricultural activity.
Use, and it has to do with the fact that you
want to be able to make it a primary use on the farm. I want to be able to raise the worms on the farm.
Okay.
Without having to do 15 other things to coincide with it to be able to. And then ultimately vermiculture becomes a primary use, whether it's a secondary use, because of the financial aspect of it when you get done.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. On the feed for the worms, you mentioned cattle although their byproducts is being a part of it. Also, any other organics?
Any organic.
Okay.
We see, if you take this a level or two down the road, any rural wastewater treatment plant, okay, you can treat their biosolids. The process becomes a Class A product. You can address urban and municipal waste issues. We've done primary clarifier sludge from the paper mills. We've done primary sludges from food processing. We've done biodegradable food waste, paper, anything that you can grind and that will grow bacteria that's non-toxic, you can feed to them, and they come up with a pretty good product at the end. But I didn't want to focus on the recycling part of it, but that is a part of it, because I'm going to need people. If I can get the methodology accepted as a viable methodology for certain forms of waste management, then you're going to need people to grow the worms, to put in the equipment, to put into the municipalities or to wherever the point that you were going to do a recycling program or organics, things like that. And you don't have the vector issues with this process on major organics as you do with composting. You don't have the odor, you don't have the seagulls, you don't have the other, they're not drawn because it's a mesophilic process. And the worms, being the largest soil animal in the box, it's called vermiculture. But basically you're using the worms and the biology that the worms put out to reduce and render accessible materials inert and useful, you know, cow manure, things like that. Or you can go to Purina and buy Purina worm chow if you want. But, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Again, just for my own, because I had done some research on this a while back, but different kinds of worms. What are we talking about here in this particular...
We're talking about a native species here in Oregon, Icenia foetida, red wigglers, brandling. Yeah. You can also... There's people that's been working in the Midwest, because Icenia is a topsoil builder. You find them in the top 18 inches of the planet. Their main objective is to take decaying forest materials, leafy materials, whatever falls naturally, and turn it into a water-soluble plant food. There's some people working back in the Midwest that are using the night crawlers, because they aerate the soil, because they burrow. And so in hard clay areas and some other places, they're actually developing a seeder, where when the seed goes in the ground, an egg casing goes in the ground with the seed to help the field stay fertile and break up the soil and become more productive.
Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Holcomb, as Representative Furley said, it's not often people come in and ask to be regulated. Have you had discussions with the Department of Agriculture on how they would regulate this industry? Or?
No, I haven't discussed it with the state of Oregon. No, I would assume it would be regulated as any other state has done it. You know, we would be subject to any environmental issues or any other issues that would become prevalent. Of course, if you do it right, you don't have these issues. What we're looking at is in Georgia and Michigan and through a lot of the fishing states, they're raised as bait worms, and the castings are sold as a side. Well, I'm kind of trying to turn it around a little bit because of the benefit to agriculture and the issues with petrochemical fertilizers and organic plant food fertilizers, pesticides, things like that. And there's not a finer organic product out there. I don't mean just my worm castings. I mean anybody's worm castings. The results at the University of Ohio, you know, we're getting 30 to 40% increase in yield in wheat and higher because of the germination ratios and the germination tests. We're up in the 99 percentile. You're getting a hardier, healthier plant. You're getting early root and leaf development in the plant, which gets it quicker through a real susceptible period of its growth in the early beginning. And you're getting you're getting pest and disease resistance at this point, I would say, because the work that we've done so far shows that we're controlling those pests that I mentioned, and in that control we're affecting the yield and getting a higher yield. But there again, we don't know the vehicle. We don't know whether it's something in the casting the plant does for an uptake, or if it's something that allows the plant to manufacture an antagonist. We believe the plant's manufacturing an antagonist. We believe it's biological. But at this point, we're not sure.
Did that answer your question? Representative Sumner?
Sir, in Section 1, Line 6, says to use as an animal food protein source.
Yes.
Worms will actually... Or the worm products will actually...
No, the worm themselves.
Worms will be fed to other animals.
Right, right. You can dry them and turn them into... pelletize them.
Yes.
Or you can feed them live to aquaculture. Most of the work was done, looked at drying them and putting them into things like dog food, chicken food, you know, other things that require a certain amount of protein in the mix, horse food, things like that.
Follow, please.
Yes.
I presume then that this has been thoroughly tested as to the safety.
Absolutely.
I understand that's how mad cow disease got started.
Not with
worms.
Meaning
other animal parts too.
Well, okay, it did, but worms aren't in that food chain, I guess you could say, and. I would like to see, I believe that, you know, if you take vermiculture, you could probably control some of the issues of the dead cows that have, because we have found nothing that they don't, as far as a pathogen goes, that they don't destroy. We've done primary clarifier solids or primary sewer solids. That's betwixt and between, but that's, and we've come up with class A material. The same with cows and chickens. And we've done the pathogen work to see that the pathogen control is there. I can produce these reports, but 20 copies of them would be about.
Yes, sir. But where I was going with this is being included in the agriculture of Oregon, then you would be subject to those inspections and those wholesomeness tests.
Well, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
That's not a problem.
That's what I'm adding.
Oh, okay. No, that's not a problem at all. That wouldn't be any problem.
The committee has checked with the Department of Ag, and they don't have any objection to this, but would be willing to come answer any questions if we would want them to. So
good.
I think that might be something we might want to pursue on another hearing. Okay. Yes, Representative Burley.
Thank you. How many people in the state of Oregon would benefit from this law being passed?
That depends on how far you take it. Farming-wise, probably several thousand farmers that could grow worms if the industry grew. Environmentally speaking, the entire state, because if you have a dairy down the road that has an issue, we can take that issue away and put a high-grade product back on the market that resolves issues. You can use, as example, environmental work. You can use castings to border waterways that are heavily pastured. You can get up to a 30% reduction in surface phosphate runoffs due to the alkaline nature of the casting, and it breaks the phosphate down. This works the same with golf courses. This works the same with other places where they have waste, you know, water runoff issues, where they have phosphate issues that they have to resolve, orchards, vineyards. So in allowing the industry to grow or become an industry, I believe the entire state would benefit, ultimately. You wouldn't have the wastewater treatment plant issues that you have. We wouldn't be spending however many thousands of dollars a day we spend in Oregon City to have it all trucked over to the eastern Oregon, spread on the ground. I believe that there would be a great benefit to it.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair. regarding that issue, you mentioned it slightly, but E. coli and other kinds of issues that are found in waste products
right.
in those deals, what happens with those and our worms?
They're destroyed. We've been working on this for 5 years, and I can produce laboratory results and laboratory analysis if you need them that shows that we control E. coli, salmonella, enteric viruses. We worked with a benign polio virus. Those were the major ones. We've taken it farther than what your wastewater treatment plant requires them to do today to put the water back in the river. And we've achieved class A material with all of these products, either non-detect or below the decimal point in pathogens, which means that you can put it where kids and puppy dogs play. It's a great product.
Great. Thank you very much. I think what we'll do on this is maybe have another hearing on it and have the Department of Ag come answer the questions of the committee. It sounds like fascinating.
I'd love to be here.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll let you know. Thank you.
Take it home and use it on your houseplants. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
And if you got any that are particularly in bad shape, use it on there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. For your time.
I only had one person signed up that testifies. Is there anybody else here? Okay, I'll close the public hearing in House Bill 2581. And committee will contact the Department of Ag and review this again. I'm going to open a public hearing and get my glasses on House Bill 2111. And Patrick, you want to explain that?
Yes, Madam Chair. House Bill 2111 excludes rights under proceeds from mineral or geothermal resources that are acquired by the Department of Transportation from the provisions and statute requiring such proceeds to accrue to the common school fund. It excludes those rights also from requirements that they be subject to exploration permits or leases by the Department of State Lands, and also requires an intergovernmental agreement between DSL and ODOT to govern the management of those resources.
Great, thank you. We have John Jackley from ODOT who is here going to testify. And we don't have any revenue or...
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I should mention that. We have not yet received a fiscal or revenue impact statement on that. Legislative Revenue Office had a paperwork mix-up or something and did not get it on their docket. So they are just now, this morning, taking their first look at the measure.
Oh, okay.
And Legislative Fiscal Office is waiting for information.
Thank you very much. Good morning. For the record, you want to identify yourself?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Jackley, the Executive Officer for the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation.
Thank you. Do you want to...
Please. I appreciate the opportunity to testify with you this morning. House Bill 2111 would resolve a conflict between existing statute and the Oregon Constitution over proceeds from mineral or geothermal rights on property that the department has or has acquired. And the reason is this. The Constitution dedicates these proceeds to the Highway Trust Fund. Statute, however, directs proceeds from mineral or geothermal rights to the Common School Fund. Both the Department of Justice and the Division of State Lands are aware of this conflict, and at the direction of the Department of Justice, when we do have these proceeds infrequently, they've been appropriately deposited into the Highway Trust Fund. House Bill 2111 eliminates this conflict. There are other agencies who are currently excluded from this, and they include the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Veterans Affairs, and the State Board of Higher Education. This bill, at the same time, imposes the same kind of informing and consultative process with the Division of State Lands that these other agencies have. Excuse me. To put this into perspective, we currently don't have any geothermal rights, so that part wouldn't affect us on a practical level. In addition, revenue from fees that ODOT charges cities, counties, and contractors for sand and gravel for roads is already excluded from going into the Common School Fund. Those fees already go into the Highway Trust Fund. This conflict would mainly apply in a situation, for example, where we might lease a quarry to a contractor for a non-road purpose. And even in that case, we typically would take payment in kind, which would be in the form of rock or aggregate that the department would use on the roads. And currently, we don't even have any of those proceeds right now. But we might in the future, and this conflict does exist in the statute. So, in summary, House Bill 2111 aligns statute with the Constitution. It continues our current practices, which we're doing under Department of Justice direction, and importantly, it would involve no reduction to the Common School Fund. And we respectfully would request your support for the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Jaffa? None. Thank you.
I guess, yes. I'm not sure of what the problem potentially is that you're trying to get around, or maybe I missed it.
Madam Chair, Representative Hess, that's a good question. The problem is the legal conflict between the Constitution, which says when we do get any proceeds, it has to go into the Highway Trust Fund, but there's an existing statute that says these kind of proceeds ought to go into the Common School Fund. So it really just aligns the statute with the Constitution and keeps whatever minimal revenues there might be in the future over these proceeds going into the Highway Trust Fund. But it wouldn't result in any reduction to the Common School Fund from what they're already getting.
Okay, thanks. But that hasn't happened yet. I mean, we haven't had that conflict.
Well, the conflict currently, Madam Chair, Representative Hess, the conflict currently exists between the statutes, and we have had these kind of proceeds in the past. We're just trying to, in essence, clean up this conflict between the statute and the Constitution.
Okay, thanks.
Did that explain it? Okay. Representative Roblin?
Yeah, kind of a clarification on that one. Thank you, Madam Chair. That, as I understand it, right now what is happening is that you send it to the DSL, and then they send it back to you, basically. And this way, it goes directly to the your fund.
Madam Chair, Representative Urban, that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Is there anybody else here who wants to weigh in on 2111? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2111. Does the committee just want to move this bill to the floor?
What's it?
Do you want to just move this bill to the floor?
Madam Chair, it feels like a consent calendar bill.
That's what I'm thinking. Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2111, and I'll take a motion to move House Bill 2111 to the floor with on the consent calendar.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I move 2111 to the consent calendar category or to do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions? Any objections? So ordered. House Bill 2111 is moved to the floor. With the due pass recommendation put on the consent calendar. Thank you. We try to be efficient around here. We are going to do House Joint Memorial 5. Right. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 5. Patrick, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Certainly. House Memorial 5 would urge the President of the United States and Congress to appropriate monies for contracts with farmers to grow crops for the specific purpose of feeding Canada geese. And it urges the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to develop a timeline and program for reducing the number of Canada geese wintering in Oregon. Included in your packets are the Dash 1 amendments, which were submitted by the Oregon Farm Bureau. There also is a hand and growth version of the measure in your packets as well, and I believe they'll speak to that.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to ask Representative Bocas, as I see your name at the top here, if you wanted to make a quick comment or did you just call up the people to testify?
I'll reserve my comment at the end, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Roy Ellicker and Greg Addington want to come up together. That's fine. And Al?
You got the coos? I didn't know Will had keys.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to go there.
He's probably in that chair. I might change my position here.
You might. Well, do now, if you're going to. Now would be a good time. Let's see. Good morning,
Madam Chair. Thank you. For the record, my name is Greg Addington. I'm with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And I want to thank the committee for hearing this memorial today. In particular, I'd like to thank Representative Boquist and Representative Krupp for their co-sponsorship of this memorial. And I thought what I'd do is just briefly introduce the issue to you, and then I'd like to turn it over to the department to talk about some of the numbers and the complexity of the goose management issue in Northwest Oregon in particular, and how it relates to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But I thought in what you're getting handed out there, and I think it's still coming around, but there's a photo in there that shows you, and I'll talk more about this later, but if anybody doubts what kind of damage geese can do to agricultural crops, I just refer you to the photo on the. It's from the Agronomy Journal from back in 2002, and what that is about a 38-acre wheat field, or it was at one point. The green areas that you see in there are what researchers call exclosures. They are basically chicken wire, 24-inch chicken wire that is set up about 19 feet wide and 40 feet long, and the geese do not get inside of that exclosure, but they will graze everywhere around it. And so that gives you an idea of the kind of damage that we're talking about here. So with that, I want to turn it over to Roy and Ron and the department to talk about kind of the complexity of it, and then I'll come back and address what the memorial does and the Dash 1 amendments.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name for the record is Roy Elliker. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And on my right, Mr. Ron Anglin. He's our Wildlife Division Administrator. And I do appreciate this opportunity to come before the committee, and I appreciate the opportunity afforded by this HJM5 to come in front of the committee and brief the committee on some of the Canada goose issues, particularly in the Willamette Valley this state is facing. Now, it's true that we're not the only state that has very significant Canada goose problems. In fact, most of the 50 states in some way, shape, or form have real issues with Canada geese. But the issue in particular for Oregon is that because of the nature of the number of subspecies, particularly wintering in the Willamette Valley, it's a much more complicated issue than just too many Canada geese. I just wanted to make some points briefly from my testimony. And I also hope that I think each member at this point has a copy of what we call our hunter education booklet, which talks about the different kinds of subspecies of geese, as well as our Pacific Flyway Management Plan for Canada geese in Oregon. And this is much more complex document, but I wanted to kind of in particular talk about, I think, as I make a few points in my testimony, really the most illustrative thing I can point to is page 20 in this small booklet, because at page 20 it summarizes the seven various subspecies of Canada geese that winter in the Willamette Valley. And it's the task of people who are helping us control these geese, namely the hunters, that they actually have to know each of these seven subspecies, and not when they're in hand, but when they're within shotgun range. A very difficult thing for even the most expert birder to do, let alone for most hunters. But anyway, I wanted to make a few points on my prepared testimony. First of all, I think everybody here knows that geese is a federal management issue under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act 1918, that unfortunately here in Willamette Valley, it goes way beyond too many geese, but in particular it goes into the various number of subspecies that occur here, and the fact that some of these subspecies are doing well and some of these subspecies are not doing well. And in particular, looking towards the bottom of page one, we talk about the management problems associated with a particular subspecies of Canada geese called a cackling Canada geese, which is a very small Canada geese as compared to most, but ones that are particularly important to subsistence harvests to Alaskan natives. And I know that Greg is going to talk about that some. There's an amendment regarding that issue. And actually, Greg's had the pleasure of going to Bethel, Alaska, not just once, but twice. Oh, and to meet with the UPICs and other Alaskan natives on the issue of cackling Canada geese. And I think I'll let him talk about his experiences in Bethel. But anyway, it's important to note, going to page two, that our primary role is administering the permit goose seasons and working with the feds and private landowners in trying to keep these geese on the move, not letting them build up in any one place in the valley where they really inflict overwhelming damage, but rather to try as best as possible to work particularly with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service to, as much as possible, try and keep most of the geese in some way, shape, or form on the federal refuges that were created for the purpose of Canada geese management in the valley, and also working with the hunting season to keep these geese on the move and not let depredation in any one particular spot get too overwhelming. It's cumbersome and expensive to administer, and the bottom line is that here as a state, originally when we got started down the road on all this geese management, we were receiving upwards of $200,000 per year from the federal government to help assist in these efforts, since geese, Canada geese in particular, are a federal management issue. But in the last two federal funding cycles, we've not received one penny from the federal government to assist us, and we've had to find other funds, particularly waterfowl stamp funds that are 100% supplied by hunters. We've had to dip in those funds to keep the current hunting seasons intact in the valley. And those hunting seasons are not, they're complex, they're hard to administer, and a lot of the complexity comes because the federal government requires us to have that complexity in how we manage these geese and how we hunt them. And so, which was fine when they funded a good portion of these extra administrative issues, but now that we're not receiving any money, it's getting to be a real problem for the state. And that concurs my prepared testimony, and I want to turn back to Greg to perhaps talk about more specifically the Farm Bureau issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I'll just go briefly through some of my remarks here. And I know with this issue, as you can tell by the amount of information you've just got from us, I mean, it's a very complex issue, and I think we could talk about it for a long time. I want to be cognizant of your time and allow for questions if there's details. So I'll kind of go over this fairly quickly, but more than happy to answer questions at the end. The department didn't really hit on it, but the numbers that I've been looking at is that the goose population in the Lower Columbia River Valley and Willamette Valley has skyrocketed in the last 30 years, going from about 25,000 wintering birds in 1970 to over, I have 250,000 wintering geese today. I think that number ranges from 200,000 to 250,000. As far as the damage, we don't have really current and regular data on the damage about how much we're feeding these birds or how much it's costing landowners. But I can tell you that a 1997 wildlife damage survey that was authorized by the legislature and conducted by the Oregon Department of Agriculture, they attributed nearly $15 million a year in crop damage to geese. What we hope to gain from this memorial is a couple things. One, we want to send a message to Congress that this is a problem, this continues to be a problem, and it's not getting any better. To a large extent, the state wildlife agency's hands are tied with what they can do as far as management because it is a migratory bird. What we want the message from this memorial to be is that the federal agencies need to take some responsibility for the birds that they have here. They should manage their refuges better, in our opinion. The habitat should be maintained for geese. They should plant crops that are that will attract geese. We also want to see that adequate funding for the USDA Wildlife Services, the funding should be restored to conduct on-site landowner technical assistance. And what they do, when we had congressional appropriations back in the late 90s for this program, money went to several different places. Some of it, as Roy pointed out, went to the department for their check stations for the hunting. A chunk of that money went to the Wildlife Services folks who actually hired part-time people during the winter months when the geese are down here to help with hazing activities, pyrotechnics that keep the geese run off. You've seen these coyote silhouettes or the eagles, those kind of things were provided by Wildlife Services. We haven't had any of that funding, as Roy pointed out, for at least 3 years, maybe four. So those are the kind of things we want to get back to, some of those issues. I guess to address the Dash 1 amendments briefly, and Roy pointed out that I've been to Bethel, Alaska. I've actually only been there once. Farm Bureau's been there twice. Once was playing for me. And did I hear 6 years?
Six winters.
Winters.
Well, if Representative Boquist lived there, I may have to revise some of my comments. But Bethel, Alaska, as he will verify, is a very different part of the world. And the Yupik Eskimos are the natives up there that we went up to visit with. They are a subsistence tribe. I mean, that is their life. They fish for salmon in the summer. They freeze those salmon and eat them all winter long. And then when the geese come back in the spring, that is their protein source. Mm-hmm. And I'm here to tell you, there is nothing else there. I mean, that is it. And so it really gave us a different perspective as well. And this memorial was drafted prior to my trip up there. When I came back and visited with our committee and our members about the situation up there, they were sympathetic and wanted to put a positive kind of tone into this document and say, look, we understand the issues that the Native Alaskans have up there, and that is not where our fight is. We don't want to make this about numbers. We've tried to say, look, reduce numbers for the last 10 years, and we've gotten nowhere with that. What we want to do then is focus on, give us, federal government, give us the management tools that we need to keep these birds moving around. My members have said that they can deal with it as long as we have some tools to keep the birds moving so they just don't camp out and be in one place all the time. That's the main reason for the Dash 1 amendments. The other thing was to basically put an or into, I think, Hand and Gross version on line 20, I believe. What we wanted to do was kind of put two options out there. Number one, get back to this. Actually, it's the way it's on here is either pay us, compensate landowners for the feed that we are providing for these birds over the winter, or give us some funding to have the tools to manage this bird and keep it so it doesn't have a huge impact on our growers. And again, I'll just go back to this picture. When we had this congressional funding originally, it started in 1999, and there was partial funding for, I think, 3 years. And part of the money also went to Oregon State University. Actually, the Rangeland Resources Department developed this and has done the research on this. And the point behind this is so that we can better assess damage and use that however, you know, going forward, however we may need to use it. I mean, we can get better data on how much damage geese actually do, how much yield reduction there is. So, again, I risk probably talking too much about this, so I'll wrap it up and just be open for questions. This is a huge issue, and this is the best thing that we can do at the state level, I think, to try to increase the volume level of this issue and let the federal government know this is a big deal and we need some help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Anglin, did you want to add anything? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I think that most of the major points have already been touched upon. The only thing I might add is that the series of hunts that we have in place are very time-consuming for both the hunter and for the department. They've been successful, though, in helping us to protect the dusky Canada goose, which is of concern to the federal government, has been considered for listing, and it drives pretty much what management options we have in the Willamette Valley. So the hunt program is very essential to us to be able to help the Farm Bureau and their constituents in addressing damage within the valley. And with that, I turn it back over to you, Madam Chair, and answer questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make one more point. That in the late 90s under Kitzhaber administration, and at that time the state of Oregon had a lobbyist employed in Washington, D.C. I believe we had a state lobbyist then. Actually, we spent quite a bit of time with our state lobbyist back there, and he did spend some time on this issue, making sure that this was brought to the attention of the various congressional committees. And whether or not, I mean, now we no longer have a state lobbyist back there. I know we took budget cuts and that position went away. But it is an issue that we've worked with the governor's office closely on and have generated the governor's letters and everything else to our own congressional delegation. So we've done as a state a lot of things to try and keep this funding flowing here. But in the last few cycles, it just has not gotten done. It's just not coming in. So now it's getting to be a real issue for us.
Great. Any questions of the panel? None?
I've got one question regarding the amendments, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm understanding this. If I look at the hand engrossed by staff copy,
right?
It. Never mind. I answered my own question.
Oh. I love those kind of questions. You?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
The opportunity.
We have Al Elkin who wants to come up.
Good Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I cannot add anything that has not already been said, other than the fact that we've worked closely with the department, sending letters to Congress, worked with congressional delegations since 96, 95 on this problem, and trying to maintain a funding level. My only recommendation would be that this is a good step forward. We might want to include a letter from the committee stating how important this is to the state of Oregon and the need to get additional funding into the state to maintain these programs. Every little bit helps. As Mr. Elliker said before, there was a person back there that kept hammering on it. Obviously, there's a correlation between having a body back there and the funding, in my opinion. That's gone, and the funding is gone as well. So whatever we can do to keep hammering the delegations is to our benefit. So we're there to help. We do send letters. We do make phone calls. We have 10,000 members that can actually use computers and emails, and so we can help in any way we possibly can. We will. But I think a letter, cover letter from your committee, Madam Chair, would be very helpful at this time. That concludes my testimony.
Any luck on the congressional level with our congressional delegation?
The last time I talked was about after a conversation I had with Mr. Bales about 7 months ago, and there was no real emphasis from anyone other than the department, the governor's office, and ourselves to get something done. And they are trying to, but we just need to put more pressure on them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions for Mr. Elkin? Representative Sumner?
Just as a matter of curiosity, to what do we attribute a tenfold growth in the number of geese in 30 years?
I certainly cannot answer that, but I'm sure other people can.
I'm only guessing outlawing lead shot. That could have had an effect.
I don't know. I guess that would be a good question. Maybe Roy or Ron would know.
They don't read.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. There's been a series of events that have occurred that have led to the increase. Some has been increased production in Alaska and other sites, increased production within the state of resident Canada geese. But one of the biggest shifts actually was cackling Canada geese historically wintered in California. And in the mid-90s, those birds actually started shifting north and now winter exclusively in the Willamette Valley of Oregon and in southwest Washington. So we gained an infusion of birds, 200 plus thousand birds for a period of time that historically had never wintered within this state, and that led to the largest increase.
Does that answer your question? I think it leads to another question. Why did they not continue further south?
Madam Chair, we have asked that question with the feds. California is delighted to have the birds. They would like to have the birds back. The population goals that were originally developed as part of the Cackler Goose Management Plan in conjunction with the Youth Explorer were for birds wintering in California, and we really can't explain why they decided to make the shift.
Thank
must
you.
Be a quality of life.
It must be.
Same reason the Californians are
going. Thank you very much. Thank you both. Is there anybody else here who wanted to testify on this? I'm going to close the public hearing on House of Grant Memorial 5 and open a work session. House of Grant Memorial 5. Did you want to say something?
I guess first, Madam Speaker, before I move forward, if you're good.
Make a motion.
Madam Speaker, I'm going to pass the cue sheet. And I move to adopt HGM 5-1 amendment stated March 8th.
I have a motion to adopt the dash one amendments to House Joint Memorial 5. Do I have any objections? Any discussion? So adopted. Okay, now we need a motion to move it to the floor as amended.
Got it. Madam Chair, I move House Joint Memorial 5 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. I have a motion to move House Joint Memorial 5 as amended to the floor with the due pass be adopted. Do I have any discussion?
Sure. I'd like to make a couple of comments so that they're on the record.
Sure.
First off, I didn't see any Canadian geese or Alaska geese when I was in Bethel because it was in the middle of the winter and I was a military advisor. But I can attest to you that there is not much in Bethel, Alaska. One of the reasons we brought forth, Representative Krupp and I brought forth this, and I don't want to get the esteemed representative to my far right upset here, but the agricultural crops that we have in our district are severely impacted. And to give you what we're talking about is crop destruction and then, for better polite word, the waste byproduct from these geese being on properties that are outside of federal management properties. I happen to travel every day past Basket Slough on the way back and forth. And if you look at the picture you have here in the Agronomy Journal, if you put Highway 22 in there and going out towards the coast, the problem we have is, like with other animals, is that the geese don't know where the federal refuge ends and where private property begins. And the destruction on that property for a small number of farmers is fairly great. In the early 1990s, U.S. Fish and Wildlife entertained several very interesting concepts, and this goes back to Representative Sumner's question, that the migratory pattern had changed. And one of the concepts they came up with is they thought the migratory pattern had changed because of warm water resources along the Columbia Basin, to include the aluminum mills. And so during the mid-1990s, they went into the state of Washington and tried to reproduce stopover places on the way to California. And we literally went out and created large quantities of stopover habitat for them to eat. And in a nutshell, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. They continued to fly at a certain interval, and they now land in Oregon, and they don't know the difference between the federal property where they're supposed to eat and the private property where they're not supposed to eat. And so this has been an ongoing project, and it's just, I think, as times have gotten tougher, the federal government has reduced the funding. And the problem is that, as was pointed out, because the migratory patterns have changed, they're no longer tourists to the state of California. They are consuming tourists to the state of Oregon. And that's why we brought this forward. I would urge unanimous consent, and if it does pass, I'd be happy to carry it on the floor.
Thank you. Any other comments or discussions?
Madam Chair, I know that when I was first looking at the original bill, I was gulping and thinking, oh, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know, something about those birds, you know. It was good to hear the testimony. I'm realizing I probably had a couple questions I should have asked afterwards about the department's how they would interact with this. If something was done, you know, would they have any part of developing plans or anything? But it does sound like they're supportive of the memorial, and my hope is that it would get to the point where the government would help out as opposed to have to increase hunting and all of that stuff. So yeah. I guess I'll support.
He's nodding yes. Yes.
Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me one more thing. I think the importance of adding the amendment is beyond the fact that it says, you know, we're addressing the lifestyle of the Alaska Natives, and really goes to the core matter of the federal government, and that is the state of Alaska has certain appropriators that have more horsepower in Congress than others do. And by having this particular clause in there, actually increases its success rate dramatically. And to the question that Representative Byer, we've had these programs in the past and they've been quasi-effective. They've just ended funding for them.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Correct. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you there, Senator.
Any other questions? The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Pass?
Aye.
Representative
Sumner?
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Joint Memorial 5 as amended is moved to the floor. And Representative Boquist, we would be glad to have you carry the bill. Thank you. I'll close the work session on Agenda 5. Thank you very much. Okay.
We have a work session on HJR 8. We now have the amendments in hand. And Patrick, would you like to explain those to us?
Yes, Madam Chair. The amendments, I distributed on Monday in your packet some information, some testimony we received by email from Lee Johnson with Harry and David, and he had suggested some amendments, and those are included in the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments, I should mention, also include the Dash 1 amendments. That would be on line 70 of the amendments, the deletion of the word European on line 22 of the printed bill. The remainder of the amendments include the suggestions made by Mr. Johnson. They include including the types of pears that are grown in Oregon. Also, for clarification, on line 3 of the amendments, there was some concern that the whereas clause on line 5 of the printed bill may need some clarification for the purposes of explaining that while California may grow more pears in the summer months, they don't grow. It's not nearly as efficient for growing in winter months, so that changes the language to summer and winter pear varieties to kind of help the factual basis, factually accurate basis of that whereas clause. And then also the other change on there is mention of the businesses in Oregon that produce fruit gift baskets.
Great, thank you. Any questions? I think we'll take a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to HJR 8. Mr. Roblin?
Chair, I will move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to...
Two amendments.
That's yes. Right. To House Joint Resolution 8.
Thank you. I have a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to HJR 8. Do I have any questions, comments?
Yes.
Yes.
Just to make sure that I understand the amendment, Dash 2. On the Dash 2 amendment, it says in line 22, delete European.
Right.
But we're not going to delete the scientific name?
If I may, no. The scientific name is it will remain on there.
Okay.
And that makes it clear that that's the variety that's being used, but simply deleting the word European.
Okay.
The other thing is it comes out of the summary as soon as you delete the word European in line 22, so it's an automatic thing. It's the way Legislative Council told us, so we did check on that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Do they only make these fruit gift baskets in Medford and McGriver?
The companies, if I may, that have mail order businesses are based in Medford and Hood River.
Yeah.
It's possible that there may be.
There are fruit baskets made everywhere.
Yeah.
They are, you know, the well known ones.
Is that a question or?
Sure.
Yeah. Comment.
It's a free association.
No, I know. Yeah. I guess my answer to that would be we can try everything we can to change the language on this. Everybody seemed on board with it. Seemed fine. It's a resolution. Defining the state fruit as a pear. That was the main gist of the resolution.
Distribute the amendments to the interested parties, and all of them looked at the language, and there was no opposition to that.
Right. Any other questions? I have a motion to move the Dash 2. If I have any objections, so ordered. Move the Dash 2.
Yeah, I move that we
adopt
House Resolution, House Joint Resolution 8 as amended. And sent to the floor for the 2000.
Great. I have a motion to move House Joint Resolution number 8 as amended. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Fire?
Aye.
Representative Lopez?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Tapp?
Aye.
Representative
Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Chair
Smith? Both aye. Motion passes. And Representative Patty Smith will be the chair.
Thank you for doing that. Just so the committee knows kind of our schedule, we're planning a field hearing or a hearing outside of the Capitol March 24th. I know. Spring break week.
Easter weekend.
Yeah. Well, the 25th is a day off of the legislative session. That was your in-district day, so we moved it to the 24th in Baker. It'll be an afternoon hearing. I haven't got all the details, but as soon as I know. So I wanted you to know the date. And then early April, we'll be probably doing Hood River. I don't know yet the date on that, but I will know that. I just kind of wanted to give you a heads up on that. And that's kind of what we're doing. It's really hard, difficult to get dates that don't conflict, and then to get the sound equipment. So it's really hard to do these hearings outside of the building. So, but that's the plan. So I wanted to know. And then we're not meeting on Friday.
You're going to have a meeting.
We're not meeting on just Friday. So, and then I wanted to announce that at 4 o'clock, the Department of Forestry is having a reception. I have that here somewhere. In Hearing Room 50, and we're all invited. The Board of Forestry is having a legislative reception, Hearing Room 50. And thank you.
We do not have a meeting this Friday, is that correct?
We do not. Any other comments or announcements?
Hey, Chair Smith, I missed the location on the March 24th field trip.
Baker City.
That's
a Thursday.
How long does it take?
From here, probably 7 hours, would be my guess.
So we would miss that session.
Right.
6 hours.
Yeah.
Oh, only
6.
Oh, only 6 if you weigh the speed limit. Depends on which way you go.
It's 7 hours to my ranch.
With that, we are adjourned.
We have those exempt plates on the...